Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, Michael Carney is the principal of St. Brendan's National School in Mina, and he spoke to me alongside students Ellie and Dara about the difference last year's toy show appeal has made to their school. Barbara Walsh is chair of the Glen Cree Centre for Peace and Reconciliation, and she told me about a nearby German war cemetery and how it came to be in a County Wicklow village. Niamh Ní Cara is an archivist at NUI Galway, and she spoke to me about the Explore Your Archive initiative, which is encouraging people to take a trip back in time with a visit to their archives. And Caroline O'Donnell talked to me about staying hopeful and being thankful for those around her after a year that put her resilience to the test. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy it. Let me say good morning to Michael Carney because he's standing by. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
What part of the world are you in, Michael?
We're in Kilmina, just outside Westport in County Mayo, Ryan.
Okay, then. Well, describe to me, please, your school.
Well, our school is a country school, as I said, nestled between Westport and Newport. And we're four class teachers, two learning support, and support with SNA as well. And as I said, nestled here in rural Ireland. And we've done lots of developments over the last couple of years. And it really is a beautiful area and a beautiful school. And we're very proud of it.
Sort of the Alice Taylor school of old-fashioned Ireland, kind of still alive and well, but with a modern twist.
Indeed, with a modern twist. As I said, we're very fortunate with the facilities we have here, and great credit is due to everybody over the years.
Great.
For making it so lovely.
Okay, good. 80 pupils, four teachers. Is it a busy school, Michael? Is it a good vibe in the school, or is it too small, or too? How would you describe it?
I think it's absolutely perfect. As
Great.
I said, it blends in with the community, and it is very much a focal point to the community as well.
Yeah, which is of course critical. And are the kids good, or are they painful?
And they're very good, and we're very, very fortunate with the support we have of the parents and the children. They're our privilege to work with, and we're very lucky.
Yeah.
Of course, in these very strange times, it's very, very difficult, but kids have amazing coping skills, cope much better than adults at times.
Do you believe that?
I do, yeah. I mean, they get on with it. You know, we probably complicate things too much, I think, at times. But when you go into school, and I know it's very difficult with schools at the moment and the situation, the world we're living in and with COVID and everything like that, but kids have great coping skills. They just get on with it, and they like routine. And as I said, you know, things are moving on as per normal as they can be. And I know it's difficult. We have segregated and we have pods and we have, you know, staggered breaks and things like that. But having said that, you know, kids are great. They come in the morning and they're in great form, and it's as a normal day as it has been. But of course, COVID has a huge impact in our community, no more than every other community in the world.
Of course. You know? Where's the nearest library to your school?
The nearest library is in Westport. And
it's a great library.
It is. It's a lovely little library, and they've been very, very good to us over the years in regards to supports of the school. But of course, as you well know now, we have a new venture in place, which is fantastic for our community and our school.
Now, it's Monday morning. People are a bit COVID-y, so we need a good news story. Michael, tell me what happened.
Well, basically what happened is, Ryan, that our school was chosen as one of four schools out of hundreds of applications in the country to be part of the Reading Communities, which was Every Child a Reader project organised by Children's Book Ireland and, of course, funded by ourselves and the Late Late Show. And we were very, very fortunate to be chosen. It's a wonderful venture for the school and indeed the community. And we have been gifted 1,000 books, which is a phenomenal library in itself. I'm here in the library at the moment looking round, and we received our first instalment of 250. But not alone that, we will be very fortunate to be also given an illustrator to work with Kim Sharkey for the next 3 years. And that's a wonderful venture.
This comes back to what I was saying earlier on. For people who wondered, follow the money. Where did the money go that they dug deep in for last toy show?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
here's your answer. 1,000 books over 3 years in this beautiful school, which is, it doesn't have a library to speak of in the village, of course, because it's small. So you're in the library now.
I'm in the library now, and I know there's children that are going to speak to you. And I'm just looking around. It's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
And the great thing about this is that all the children can bring their books home. We have a scanner system set up.
Oh, great.
you know, to see kids walking in on a Monday morning with books under their arm and having a chat, little chats among themselves about books and that, it's fantastic. And it's a new venture for us. As I said, we are a country school, and to have this facility on our doorstep is just amazing and a huge opportunity for all our children. I'm looking here at a mural on the wall which says, the more you read, the more you know, the more you read, the more places you will go. And look at this, and the books, the quality of the books from the staff of Children's Book Ireland, and, you know, the topics they cover, they cater for all types of abilities, and, you know, it's great, and it's fantastic to see the excitement with the children and the staff of the school, and for that we are extremely thankful.
Well, it's wonderful. What sort of state had it been in pre this award?
Well, we did very well over the years. We kind of begged, borrowed, and, you know, and stole, if the word was to be used. So, but the content and the quality, people have been very good over the years, including the libraries and parents bringing in books. But this is a huge, huge step up. You know, the books are fantastic. There's so many different topics, so many different authors. Delighted to say so many Irish books as well, and local authors, and, you know, Irish authors. And it's just a wonderful facility to have.
It's good. Well, I say hello to a couple of the young readers.
Please
among
do.
Us.
Yes, indeed.
I'll say hello to Ellie McDonald's in fifth class. Hello, Ellie.
Hello.
How are you doing today, Ellie?
Good.
Good. Tell me what you're reading.
I am reading a book right now. It's called A Place Called Perfect by Helena Devon.
Tell me all about it.
So it's basically about this girl that moves into with her. She moves into a new town.
Yeah.
A place called Perfect is the town. Perfect. And with her parents, she moves in with her parents, and they all have to wear glasses. Ooh. To stop them from going blind.
Oh.
And, but it's like a mystery book. And, basically it like makes the glasses kind of trick everybody into seeing what they want to see in the town. And it makes them think that the town is perfect.
Oh, that sounds really, good. That's like a Twilight Zone episode. You haven't finished it, but you're loving it.
Yeah, I love it. It's my favourite book.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. And tell me, what day is Library Day for you?
Library Day is Friday for us.
And tell
towards
me,
the end of the day.
Of course. And tell me, is that an exciting day for you? What do you do on Library Day?
Well, everybody on Library Day, on Friday, brings in their books, and then you can trade out your book for a new one if you want a different one, or we have a bunch of like cushions in our library, and we'll be able to sit down and just read our books.
Oh, it's wonderful. You've got a beautiful American accent.
Thank you.
Tell me, where were you born?
I was born in America, New York.
New York, New York?
Yeah.
And now you're living in Mayo?
Yeah.
And you're living in the beautiful village that we've been hearing all about in Kilmina?
Yeah.
Now, what's it like, how old are you?
I am 11.
What's it like to be 11, to go from the concrete jungle and skyscrapers of New York to the beautiful trees, and I don't think there's even a shop in Kilmina, but certainly to the village of Kilmina. Can you explain to me how you managed the enormous shift in your world? It's a big question.
I don't know.
But has it been...
I like to go over to my friends' houses. I hang out with them like all the time.
And do you miss New York?
Yeah, I do a lot. What? I miss, like, the houses are so spaced out here. I just prefer to be all close together. And our school is also massive in America. And I really, really miss that.
You prefer the bigger school, did you?
Yeah, we had a massive one. 6 stories.
Holy smoke. And what food do you miss?
Sorry?
What food do you miss?
Oh, I am in America.
I lost.
I was in, it's called PS-153.
Okay. I think I went down the wrong road there for a second, Ellie. I missed you. We got lost in translation. But thank you for telling me about that amazing book, A Place Called Perfect. And let me say hello to Dara is there as well. Hello, Dara.
Oh, yeah.
Dara, how are you doing?
Hi.
What class are you in?
I'm in 6th class.
Good man. So which makes you what, 12?
Yeah, I'm 12.
What are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading a book. It's called The K, the K. C-A-Y.
Okay, tell me about it.
It's by Theodore Taylor.
Yeah.
And it's about Philip and his mother. It's about in World War II. Philip and his mother, they're on a ship to Virginia, and it sinks. And Timothy, an old black sailman, he's blind too, is stuck on a raft with Philip, and they're both together stuck.
Okay.
And he has a little cat, a black cat, and it's really interesting.
Okay, cool. And do you think you're reading a little bit more diary since the library got revamped?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's great to be reading more, because with these new books, you can see loads of different pictures and colours, and it's nice to be able to enjoy a picture book sometimes too, you know?
I like that, I like that. Listen, have a great day, Dara. Thank you for your time. I'll go back to Michael and say goodbye to you. Michael.
Thanks, Ryan.
Not at all.
No, it's absolutely fantastic. And thank you so much again for the exposure and also for the funding. As you said, you know, people put their hands in their pockets.
That's
and
it.
We just want to thank sincerely. And before we go, Ryan, it would be remiss of me not to congratulate the Community A team. We won the county final on Saturday.
I know you did. The county junior football title on Saturday.
It's absolutely
huge day.
Unbelievable. Yeah, it's incredible. And the life, you know, you talk about good times and happy stories in these difficult times. I mean, a lot of our former pupils in the school as well have been involved in the team, but to the team management, the GA is so much an integral part of our community, and it's just over the road from us, so we're thrilled for everybody involved.
Were you the underdogs or the favourites?
We were the favourites for a change,
but
it was a very, very tight game, and great credit to Kilcommon as well. But as I said, it has lifted the whole community, and every child in the school as well is so involved in the club, and we have wonderful officers and people that give all their time voluntary, and the team and management, so we're very, very proud.
It's amazing.
It's a great news story as well, you know.
So Kilmina's buzzing today.
Kilmina's buzzing today. Yeah, there's a wonderful atmosphere.
Delighted.
As I said, and look, we're very privileged and we're very thankful for all the support we've received. We're very genuine with that.
I look forward to visiting the school someday, he says, inviting himself along to see you.
Absolutely.
All.
Absolutely, you're always welcome.
I'd love to. I'd love to. Sure, I'm
very
off in
much.
That part of town. So, Michael, best to you and to, I know Vice Principal Mary Staunton's involved in the whole
Absolutely.
Project as well, so
Absolutely.
And to the other pupils. Enjoy. Happy reading. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks very much, Ryan.
Great
God bless.
Talking to
Take
you.
Care.
Okay,
Bye-bye.
This is great. Let's. Barbara Walsh, good morning to you, Barbara.
Good morning, Ryan.
It's,
how are you?
It's very nice to talk to you. You are the chair of the Glen Cree Centre for Peace and Reconciliation, is that right?
That's right. I chair the board there at Glen Cree.
Good on you. And you know something, Barbara? I've passed by the centre a few times. If, you know, when you're driving around the countryside, sometimes it's a beautiful location. And I remember my father brought us when we were kids and said, that's the German cemetery. I was probably too young to understand what it was, but it's right beside it in this sort of strange twist of fate.
Yeah, it is. It's right beside it, and I suppose there are connections, kind of formal and informal connections, that have developed there over the years.
Yeah.
But the German cemetery itself, you know, there's 134 dead victims of conflict and war buried there. 75 of them are unidentified. 40 of them were German citizens that were deported from the UK during the war. They were on their way to Canada, and a German U-boat shot at them, and 40 of them were washed up near Tory Island, and they ended up being buried in Glen Cree.
So you've about
including one Jewish person.
Right. Okay. So you've about 134 graves of mainly Luftwaffe. Is that right? And Navy personnel.
Some of them were Luftwaffe. Some of them were civilians. A few of them were from World War One, so these were young men mainly that were either washed up, were either dropped down from airplanes, or civilians that were killed during the war. So, and there's 120 there from World War Two. So all of those were scattered all over the country. And then they were brought together by the German embassy and the German government when they were collecting their own war dead. And they found a resting place in Glen Cree, you know. So there's a lot of kind of untold stories, you know, in there. There's a 19-year-old there who was, I think, came down over the Black Stairs Mountain. His name was Kurt Tiggerman.
Mm-hmm.
He was just 19 years old. Lay there for years and years, was local knowledge sort of identified that he was buried there, and then he was brought to Glencree as well. So,
and why were they not repatriated, I wonder, to Germany?
I don't know that.
Yeah, strange
one. I don't know that.
And why, I suppose the German government then what, wanted them all in one place, is that it?
They did. They saw those as war dead, their own war dead, and they wanted, I suppose, to honour them and to honour them as human beings, you know. So I suppose when sometimes people say to us, were they this, were they that, you know, what we say is that they were all human beings, they were all young, they were all the victims of war, and I suppose that in a way connects up with the work of Glencree.
Because
that
the of course, and the obvious thing is to say, well, they're Nazis, Barbara, you know, and I'm sure that gets said a lot in the area, because they would have been, if there were War II, their Luftwaffe, their Navy personnel, they would have been part of the Nazi machine, and yeah. and that is what gives it that sheen of mystery, if you like, or peculiarity.
Well, we never think of it like that. In a way, we just look at the age of them. They're all between 19 and 25. You know, who knows what they thought they were fighting for. Like a lot more youngsters that are involved in wars today and in conflicts today, including on our own island, you know. So we don't go into that. Every year we, you know, throughout the month of November, we recognise the fact that they're there. We pray for or recognise the futility of war in many different cases. And over the last couple of years, then, we've brought together members of the diplomatic community, you know, from Germany and France and Holland, and anybody that wants to come, along with our own defence forces and local people, to talk about the stories that they have now currently heard and the efforts that they have made to create, you know, to create peace and reconciliation. Like, for example, Adrian O'Murica, who's the Assistant Chief of Staff now in the Defence Forces,
yes,
told a story there recently about when he was working for the EU and he was assigned there. There was a young military woman who was being decorated, you know, and the decoration was to happen sometimes at lunchtime. And she asked that her German counterpart would pin the decoration or the promotion on her. And the reason she asked that was that their great-grandfathers had fought in the First World War, their grandfathers had fought in the Second World War, and that basically she wanted to recognise the importance of the European Union in recognising that whatever fighting goes on now goes on round a table, not people absolutely killing each other.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, it's such a good point you make, and that person makes, because I remember going over to the UK to do the Late Late Show over there, and there was a beautiful statue to peace in Europe just outside, just nearby Downing Street, and there was a lot of talk of Brexit maybe happening at the time, and I thought, this statue sums up exactly why Europe as a union is there, is to prevent what you've just described happening again, two horrible, slaughtery wars in close proximity. And that's where the Centre for Peace and Reconciliation comes in. I mean, it's just such a bizarre coincidence that you're that close to that cemetery.
It is. There are, of course, no coincidences.
Well, there's truth there. There's truth.
And the European Union itself, you know, provided a framework for the Good Friday Agreement, along with America, of course. But it also enabled us on this island to have a wider framework rather than looking at two different identities, that kind of stuff, you know.
Yes.
So people, and I suppose, you know, Glencree in its own way came out of the Civil War, Ryan.
Oh.
Because Una O'Higgins O'Malley was the daughter of Kevin O'Higgins, who was
assassinated
in 1927, you know, and her life was devoted to reconciliation, to just helping people, North and South, understand each other better, East, West as well, you know, helping all of us on these islands to create the conditions for peace. And Glencree has stood for that possibility, that there can be peace anywhere when we act on what's really important to us, you know.
You talk about Una O'Higgins O'Malley, and she was, her father was killed, I think it was Cross Avenue in Booterstown.
That's right, yeah.
And that was about 1927. So but was his father also shot?
His father was also shot because of who he was.
So this is what always fascinates me about people like Una Higgins. And I was watching the Mary McAleese documentary recently. I don't know if you saw it, but it was, the point is, and I'll never forget him, Gordon Wilson. Do you remember in Enniskillen? And his daughter was dying in the rubble, and he was reaching to... And whatever, after that, regardless of the fact that his own daughter was killed in such a horrible way, he still talked about praying with his wife for the people who did that.
Yeah.
And some people can emerge from the darkest tragedies with their dignity and sense of soul intact in a way that I never could. You know, some people are like that, like Una O'Higgins, O'Malley. Yeah. And you must see a lot of this type of person maybe at the centre in Glencree.
Yeah, well, you know, and usually it comes out of people. Sometimes it comes out of suffering, you know.
Yes, yes.
So in some way or another, she really transformed her suffering and her loss of her father, which she would say she missed her whole life. Who missed her whole life, and she was well into her 70s, you know, when she died. But really what her kind of motto was, and Glencree's motto is, well, what can we do now? The context changes in Ireland. You know, Glencree were active in the sense that it facilitated conversations coming up to the Good Friday Agreement.
Yes.
The place was quiet. You know, the phone lines were poor. Nobody had Twitter. Mm. And so it enabled people to be able to talk about things that were very difficult for them and to talk with people who they found very difficult to talk to.
What? Go on, sorry, Barbara.
You know, so kind of, Glencree, you know, has been, so I suppose if you were to say, what is it about in some way or another? It's about dialogue, really, helping the flow of information between people who sometimes hate the sight of each other, or to help them to make sense and meaning out of their own struggles, and then to address their fundamental concerns in a place that's safe and confidential, that enables people to be able to work through things. So it provides informal diplomacy, space for dialogue, you know, and a real strong believer in the power of relationships. So today, it's about the relationships, not just on this island, but it's between these islands.
Yes.
Regardless of the fractures caused by this or that or the other thing, we're still very deeply connected culturally, economically, you know, socially, our families are connected within all of that.
And I remember, I seem to have, I don't know why I have it in my head, Mo Molum going to visit this.
Yeah, she was in Glencree.
Yeah, that rings a bell. What was Operation Shamrock?
Operation Shamrock was the bombing of Dresden. After the bombing of Dresden, at the end of the war, like all bombings, there were families and children that were devastated and refugees, really, in their own country.
It was levelled, wasn't it, Dresden? Yeah.
Yeah, and the Red Cross and the Sisters of Charity brought thousands of children to Ireland, and Glencree was the headquarters of that at that particular time. And it was called Operation Shamrock. So brought children here, and they were fostered all over the country for a number of years. Some of them went back to their own homes, went back to Germany, but some of them stayed here. They went back, they came back, and they got married, and they had their families here. And I suppose the German president visited Glencree there recently, you know, and it was very touching to see what are now very quite old people and their grandchildren who came to meet him and tell them the story of what it was like when they came to Glencree first.
Right. And so a lot of the children that came here, I mean, that story is just reminding me of the immigrants on the Polish-Belarus border.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same.
It really is. And God, what refuge can do.
Yeah.
What a country that has these resources, if it does have the resources, can say, hold out that hand of friendship and say, look, we were you during the famine.
We were you when we emigrated. We were you.
We were you. That's it. Precisely it. And a lot of the children, did some of them stay with their foster families here rather than repatriate?
Some of them did.
Okay.
Some of them went back. Some of them came back again. you know. So it's very moving to see that, and to see their grandchildren. And I suppose in a way too, you can. There's the German cemetery. Yeah. There's every November we remember the past, we remember where we are now, we remember forward and what we need to do in terms of peace. Mm. And I suppose for Glencree, we're just actually in the process of publishing a 5-year plan now for Glencree, and we see Glencree developing as a school for peace in a way where Harvard is for business, that Glencree will be
a
place where people can learn
from
what we have learned.
Let me get you some messages, Barbara, from listeners. I visited a German World War One war cemetery on a tour of battlefields in northern France and Belgium. The difference between the Allies cemeteries is quite marked, even down to the atmosphere. Strange, but something well worth witnessing for all ages. But Jean Gallagher was on to say, my beautiful sister-in-law, Cathy Carroll, arrived in Glencree during World War II with Operation Shamrock, because she has so many interesting stories about her time there.
Yeah.
And another said, my German aunt was rescued, starving, after the war by my uncle who was in the British Army. And when they came to live in Dublin, she went to Glencree to teach sewing to young German children who were living there. Isn't that lovely? And Joyce in Rathfarnham says, my husband and I happened to be to visit the German cemetery yesterday. It was a beautiful day and the cemetery was so quiet and respectful. It's a very inspirational place to visit. I must definitely go back. And Moira says, the Glencree Peace Centre has the best coffee and cake, all homemade, and it's a real find. That has to probably help grease the wheels of conversation, Barbara.
I'll tell you, it does. And the other thing about, I suppose, what we've discovered or what we know in Glencree is actually that hospitality is really important.
Yeah. Well, the ancient Greeks would say that.
And it does have
that.
The best coffee and cake.
Well, I'm going to put that to the test next week when I come down. The cemetery is in Glencree is a beautiful, gentle place to visit and really makes you think, says Isabel Murta. Can people visit the centre if they want, or is it by appointment, or what's the...
No, the centre itself is open. There's a coffee shop. The one with the cake and the coffee is on the site. So
critical.
It's there. A lot of the work at the moment, I suppose, with COVID and all the rest of it, so some of the work is residential with people, and for some it's outreach. So it depends on any one day on what's going on. The current work, you know, at the moment is, you know, we support women in leadership that come, a lot of those are coming from conflict areas, and in some way it's also supporting women to be at the top table when peace agreements are being signed. Because in a lot of cases, they are not. And they make a significant difference where they are and where they have been engaged in peace agreements.
Yeah,
been proved that they've lasted longer within all of that. So that's
it. It's fascinating, Barbara. I look forward to seeing you down there soon. And thank you for your time this morning. Good to talk to you.
Not at all. You're welcome.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Barbara Walsh is the chair of the Glencree Centre for Peace and Reconciliation. It's a beautiful, leafy spot in the depths of Wicklow. And if you're in the area, I'm sure you'll swing by and see the centre and get your coffee and visit the cemetery and just have a look. It's fascinating. What time are we at? 9:09. But we also wanted to talk this morning to somebody who travels in time between the eras through the archives. And her name is Niamh Ní Chaire, who's an archivist at the NUI Galway. Niamh, good morning to you.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
It's nice to talk to you.
Same as that. Thank you very much.
I love that.
You made me hungry there with that description.
It's just cake, you see. You've got to get the right cake. Like if you were having a cup of coffee in the morning or tea, what cake would you want?
I don't know. You see, I go French anyway. I go, you know, the pain au chocolat, the croissant, something. Yeah, yeah.
I had one of
those. But you can get some great recipes in the archives as well.
Go on.
I think is it that brilliant series, the Lords and Ladles.
Yes.
That I don't know if you remember.
Of course
that's
I do.
A brilliant series, and they dive through the archives and they check what meals were cooked at a particular period, and they try and recreate them, which leads to all sorts of hijinks.
Well, it does lead to hijinks because the stuff they make you eat is so bizarre.
Weird order of food and weird types of food to us, I suppose, to our current sensibilities, perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, the other one that just we're going off piste here, but one of the programmes I watch every year is Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall. It's Christmas special from about 15 years ago where he makes a medieval Christmas feast, which involves 12, essentially 12 birds, one inside another, inside another, inside another. And he goes and shoots them and finds them and hunts them. And it is extraordinary. He cuts it down like a tree to find it with the rings, and everyone gets a piece of it. It is amazing. But do you come across food in your archives?
You do. You'd have, I mean, all different sources. So it depends on the archive. And I suppose that's a really good way of talking about this. Archives cover a multitude of subjects and can go off on tangents, and you can go down rabbit holes depending what you're looking at. So you could find a recipe that's sent as a letter from a mother to a son who has emigrated, or you could be looking at the list of ingredients that were bought in a big manor house, or, you know, there could be recipe books going back in age. And again, it depends on where you are, what archive you're in.
Well, can we find Christy Moore's song? I'm sorry, I've always wanted to play this, and this it just comes up now. Christy Moore wrote a song, right, which was a list of the ingredients, or at least the list of things in a big house in Ireland in 1846 or 7, right in the middle of the famine. And he lists it off, and it's really unnerving because there's so much food and so much hunger. So, go on.
Yeah, that's exactly it. If you look at the page and you're looking at that list, it's just a list of ingredients. What Christy has done is put the context there. And that's a huge part of our job as well. If you're looking at an individual page, you know, if you see something online,
yes,
a major part of the archivist's job is to explain, well, yes, that's just a single page, but this is the context from which it comes, so that you understand it properly, you know, and you get the full picture. So, yeah.
And Niamh, I don't know what age group you are, but, and it doesn't really matter necessarily, but let's say when you were a student or heading into your 20s or whatever, if you're not still there, and somebody said to you, oh, you want to be an archivist, or, oh, you're an archivist, what do you think most people's perception of what an archivist looks like, sounds like, and is like?
Well, you have the, I don't know what they're called, you know, the cardigan that's over a jumper. There's that cliche, you know, it kind of follows on from the cliches of the librarian.
Yes.
You have the idea that we're like Harry Potter working in the under the stairs in the dustiest room of the place, and yeah, that it's all about books, and that the only place would be a library or say a National Archive, and all of those things. In some cases true, but for the most part, the absolute opposite, you know.
You're not dusty and musty and fusty.
It's cutting edge stuff. Cutting edge stuff. So, you know, every archive would be storing things in at particular temperatures and particular humidities based on what it is, what the medium is. You've brand new buildings being built all the time. Off the archives, for example, a few days ago, they have a new building in Tullamore that was officially opened by the Minister of State for Heritage, Malcolm Noonan. There's a brilliant, one of my favourite buildings in Dublin is the Irish Architectural Archive that essentially retrofitted a gorgeous Georgian building.
Where's that? I'd love to see that. Where's that?
It's Marion Square.
Oh, lovely.
Marion Square.
Okay.
And they regularly have open days, and you see this gorgeous building. In fact, they restored it to its original building, which was one single house. It had been divided into two going back, and the archives are actually underneath in brilliant conditions, you know, temperature controlled.
Of course.
The building itself, of course, wouldn't really be suitable for archives at all. So what they've done is very clever. You know, the outside of the back has the lift that goes up and down. So you're looking, it's a glass lift. So you're looking out at the back of the building. It's like a spine on the back of the gorgeous Georgian building. So, you know, you're
Sounds
looking
lovely.
At modern and old at the same time. Yes, that's a very good example.
I love that. I like old school with a modern twist.
That's us in a nutshell,
yeah.
Ryan, I think.
Okay, got it. What are you working at archive-wise at the moment, Niamh?
So I am very, very lucky. I am working over in NUIG on two fantastic, iconic collections.
Right.
The Conor Na Gaeilge collection, which I'm almost finished, which goes back to the very start.
What
of
is that?
Conor Na Gaeilge. So Conor Na Gaeilge is the Gaelic League, and it was an organisation that was set up in 1893 to promote Irish language and its use kind of in all areas, non-religious, non-sectarian. But a lot of the people involved at the start were also involved in the setting up, you know, they were involved, some of them were involved in 1916. They were involved in Northern Ireland in the setting up of the new Irish state, the Free State, you know, in the 26 counties. And basically, because it covers the period from 1893 up to the present day, it kind of covers the history of our country and the history of our Ireland, and covers lots of different kind of things. So they're looking at how Irish is used. So you have things like peanut wrappers from Aer Lingus because it was bilingual. Or, you know, you have all sorts of random things in there because it was about Irish. It wasn't about anything else, you know. But the other collection that I'm working on as well is the Mary Robinson collection.
Oh, that's a big
one. It's a big one. Yeah. They're both the biggest collections NUIG ever had. And of course, I'm working on both of them.
Of course,
I won the lottery on that one. So I'm still processing the collection. I know you were talking to our ambassador, Flora McCarthy.
I was.
And she got very lucky because there was no way you could do a book like that without having Mary Robinson in it. So what I still was literally opening the boxes and finding out what was there. I haven't even gotten to cataloguing stage, which will kick in next January. But because I had this relationship with Flora, and because, you know, this was going to be done one way or the other, I was basically keeping an eye out for material as I was going through it. And I would send Flora a text going, "You have a chapter on this, don't you? How about this item?" You know,
right.
And we became great friends. But yeah, it's a fantastic collection.
Are you essentially a child in a sweet shop?
Yeah, I am. But of course, the sweets can't be in the sweet shop. We get them all over the archive. Yeah, it's, I suppose one of our disciplines is that we can't go down the rabbit hole because we've a job to do.
Yes, tempting as it is.
Yeah. We have an archive to process so that everyone else can go down the archive. Go down the rabbit hole. We have to get the collections processed, catalogued, and made available, and, you know, make various decisions as well on things like GDPR and the condition of the items. If it's too fragile to physically show, then you try and get it conserved, but you'd also maybe try and get it digitized so that people can look at a surrogate copy, and lots of different decisions that are made before they're opened up, and then away with you all to explore them.
Off you go now. So if somebody wants to explore Irish film, you know, or the history of a certain type of Ireland through the media of film and what have you, you can help them.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a really good point. People would think of the National Archives, which is a fantastic building, and everything that it holds. But there are lots of different types of archives in lots of different places. So film, for example, you would find film in the Irish Film Institute, which have their own archives. That would be one place. You could find some film if it was about traditional Irish music. You could find some film in the Irish Traditional Music Archive,
really?
Which is around the corner from the Irish Architectural Archive in Merrion Square. There's a gorgeous archive down in Kerry in Dúnchuin. It's the Blasket Island Centre. So footage from the Blasket Islands before it was evacuated, you'll find that film footage there. Lots of archives would have film footage. And again, I suppose it touches on the more cutting edge element of our work. It's not all paper. It's lots of different media, which makes our life fun because, you know, a page from 200 years ago, you can still read clearly. A floppy disk from 20 years ago, you have a problem.
Yeah, of course. And did you, I mean, the Irish Traditional Music Archive you talk about there, I wasn't aware of any of these. This is great. I mean, did that archive prompt you to change career? Is that the case, that you were kind of on a fork in the road?
Yeah, so my background is a bit odd. I did electronic engineering. My mum was my physics teacher. Thanks, Mum.
Oh, nice, nice.
But I ended up working in Boston in an Irish software company, but I brought my fiddle with me and I ended up playing music in a brilliant pub that had just opened at the time called The Burn, which is still running. Lots of years later, I won't say how many.
Yeah.
But I got spotted and my name went back and I ended up being invited to join Riverdance. So I toured with them for 8 years.
Amazing. Where did you go with them?
Mainly North America, but also Asia. And even when I finished working with them full time, I would do the odd tour here and there. So some flying squad gigs, they call them, you know, where you fly out for literally 2 days and fly home again.
You're like a hit and run with a fiddle.
Literally, yeah. And the fiddle case can also look like it's a hit and run as well. It's been opened way too many times at airport security. But then I came home and I wanted to continue playing music. So I set up my own band and I've been touring my own band ever since and recording albums.
Still.
And when I was researching for those albums, I would go into the Irish Traditional Music Archives. And I suppose it's what led me to archives because the tradition, the Irish traditional music that we have grown up with, it's all about passing on to the next generation. It's about the provenance of the tunes. And that really, really drew me in, you know. And, you know, I couldn't keep touring forever. So I eventually got the day job. So, yeah, I did a master's in UCD. It's the only place in the country you can train. And I became an archivist, but I'm still playing as well. Yeah.
Oh, lovely. I love your arc in life. And it's a great lesson for people that you'd be playing the fiddle in a pub in Boston one day and then be, you know, sitting in UCD doing your homework and getting your act together for another phase in your career. Like, if you have the resources and the ability and the interest, off you go.
That's it, exactly. And I think something like archives as well, it's very complementary to a lot of other you know, jobs, you know, that you can do at the same time, but also lots of different backgrounds.
Yeah.
It used to be that you had to have a history degree, which is still very important for certain aspects of archives.
Sure.
But for example, I have a friend of mine, we run a podcast now on archives, which is called Archive Nation. Small plug.
Yes, of course.
But one of the reasons we did it is because there's lots of history podcasts out there, but nothing on archives.
Okay.
And we were talking to the lovely Liv McDonald from the National Archives, and she was saying 10% these days of researchers in the National Archives are historians. So there's 90% there from lots and lots of different backgrounds.
Yeah.
And that's the way our profession has gone. You know, we've branched out, for example, and I suppose we should get back to topic, but one of the things that's happened this week, it's a week-long campaign talking about exploring archives. One of the events was in NUI Galway. It was a conference on archives and human rights. And that's a whole new area that's
right.
Very much part of our profession, you know, archivists as activists, making sure people's stories are being kept.
Well, that is really, really interesting, isn't it? Because fake news, online doctoring, you know, deep fake pictures, whatever you're having, is so... History was always easy to rewrite. I mean, they always say the victors write history, and there's truth in that. You've also got Stalin used to do things with photographs that we now call post, you know, photograph shopping, photoshopping. And Stalin was doing that for years. And here we are now in a much more precarious situation in terms of keeping the story and the integrity of the story intact. And that's why archivists are now more important than ever before as keepers of the flame of truth.
That's exactly it. And you know, the best place to go for the original document is the source. And a lot of those are in the archives. And not just paper, but again, I mentioned about our cutting-edge technology. Digital items as well, where we can show this is the original digital item. It hasn't been doctored. There's a checksum done on it that shows it's from this exact time and nothing has been altered since. So, you know, on the digital side of things, we can do the same thing. But it's incredibly important. And it's incredibly important as well. Our profession are always saying, you know, whatever you see in the archives, make sure you know the context. If you're looking at, you know, getting back to that single document, if you come into an archive and you're looking for a specific document, the archivist will be encouraging you to read what's called the finding aid, which is where we catalogue and describe the whole collection that page may have come from. And at the start of that will be kind of the history of how that collection came to be in the archive. And that's really important because it'll flag things like, you know, this was given to us by a specific person. It doesn't cover this whole other area. There are gaps in the collection, or, you know, the language here isn't the language that would be used today. It may be triggering, it may be upsetting, but it's what was used historically. You know, lots of things like that. So that background context is really important. And it's what brings the truth to the document. Because if you take a document out of context and you specifically put it in a different context, you can change the meaning altogether.
Okay.
So you need that context, yeah.
If it's intriguing. Can the archivist, Sinead asks, recommend a podcast on archives? Funny, preferably one by her, that I could listen to her for hours about archives. Well, there you are. It's called Archive Nation. I'm going to listen to that later on. Well, at some point this week, I hope. Archive Nation. And you do that with Cecile Shimane-Gordon, is that right?
I do. And actually, I have an exclusive for you, speaking of archives. Cecile is literally in the middle of tweeting that the 11th release of the Military Service Pensions Collection has gone live today.
Well, the excitement in your voice is palpable. that is fun and great news for all the archive heads out there this morning. And our friend Liz Nugent, a great writer, has been on to say brilliant to hear in the evening, Cara, on Fascinating as always. And Rachel says, I love that archivist, that she's working in a restored building, of course. And the archivist, says Suzanne MacDougall, in the National Gallery are all young people, contrary to the image that is often thought. The archives in the NGI include our great artist Yeats, amongst many more fascinating subjects. The research centre also there. Come and visit sometime, which of course I will. So the archive, I think you've done a great service to the archivists of Ireland today, Niamh. Thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, giving them the praise and courage and, dare I say, dignity they deserve. Not a cardigan harmed in the making of this conversation. But people can explore their archives. I mean, you're encouraging people to get online, have a look around the place, squeeze the sliced pan and see if you like it, and enjoy a little look in the past. And people can go to what website to find out all of that?
So ARA Ireland, so Archives and Records Association of Ireland, is the professional body that represents archivists and conservators and records managers. And we have a website, ARAIreland.ie,
I presume, yeah.
.ie, yeah. Yes.
Gotcha. ARAIreland.ie. And it's all, I'm going to look that up later. I'm going to keep all these notes so I can, Niamh, I look forward to it.
It's a week of exploring archives. There's online archives, there's physical exhibitions, there's talks. There's a brilliant concert happening tonight in the Irish Traditional Music Archive where Lisa O'Neill is performing and she's drawing from the well, literally. She's playing the music and looking at the music of Arthur Griffiths. There is a talk tomorrow in Belfast on children of Victorian Belfast. There's a railway exhibition in NUIG where people can go in and have a look, and that's celebrating 170 years of the railway being in Galway. Cork City Archives have an exhibition on Pag Barry that runs until April of next year.
We'll put all the details up on it.
I
have to keep moving, but thank you for your time this morning. You're terrific. I look forward to meeting you in real life very soon.
You're very welcome, Ryan, and thanks for all the messages coming in.
No, loads of them. Niamh Ní Chaire there doing a great service to us all with her talk of archives and archivists. She's there at the NUI Galway, which may have a name change in due course. But nevertheless, Niamh, great to talk to her this morning. Caroline, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Ryan.
Nice to talk to you.
And you too.
You live in the Garden County.
No, I'm Newcastle, Dublin.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were in Wicklow for some reason.
I work in Wicklow, so that might be where the lines are crossed.
That'll do nicely. Tell me a bit about yourself.
Well, I suppose I reached out looking at my own children, and I was reflecting on the past, you know, block of time that's been really hard for everybody, including my own gang. And as I kind of was observing them and looking at how they're navigating everything, I just thought how resilient they are and how wonderful they are. And themselves and so many others and so many other children. And I know specifically with the toy show this week, you know, you always shine a light on celebrating young people and children and what they're, you know, have had to go through and all of that kind of thing. So it was kind of poignant. So we're in a very grateful place at the moment. And I suppose it was a reflecting piece.
That's exactly what struck us, because really after talking to Susan and that incident on the bridge last week where they brought a man back from the brink, I felt that the country is full of these amazing stories that you won't read about necessarily in the paper or online or to be celebrated because they don't make great copy. But your story kind of resonated because, you know, as you say, a lot of people are feeling a little threadbare emotionally.
Sure.
And you kind of have taken a few hits yourself, but you want to focus and come out the other side saying, look, it's tough, but. So, for example, if we go to June then of 2020, you got diagnosed. So tell us what happened there.
Just right before that, I was working from home and like everybody, and I work in West Wicklow Youth Reach in Blessington Further Education and Training Centre, and it was live classes and it was all go, and I've three children at home and it was homeschooling, and we have additional needs in our home as well. So it was all go and very, very stressful. And my husband's a bus driver, so he was out and about. So it was really, you know, I could feel where a lot of people's frustrations were when you had to figure out how to work seesaw and all yes. the different trials and tribulations that that brought. But coming up to June, I was really, really tired, but I put it down to being stressed and, you know, like us all around that time. But unfortunately, I got diagnosed with breast cancer.
Right.
And, you know, I thankfully got in with my GP, got referred to the amazing people in breast care there in Vincent's, and they took it from there. Now, I really didn't have a huge kind of thing thinking, oh, God, I'm going in here with a lump and I'm going to have a cancer. I went in with an enlarged node under my arm and thought, I'll be heading home and it all will be fine. It's just a precaution. But our world got turned upside down. And it was really, really challenging. We had to head into, there was a few delays due to COVID of getting kind of proper assessments and things, but relatively compared to others, we did okay. But it was months of chemotherapy
yeah.
and it was surgery and it was radiotherapy in the pandemic.
You know,
again,
as you're
I'm not on my own in that.
No, I know. Appreciate that. And as you're talking about it, I'm just brought right back to what Vicky Phelan was telling me on Friday night last week about yeah. the physical horror of chemotherapy and the physical relentlessness of cancer treatment. She said it in a language I'd never heard before because it was so brutally honest. And actually, I think I really appreciated that because it made me, I feel, understand how difficult it was or it is for people going through that, because language can be used to dance around it. But actually, Vicky broke through that and said, no, do you know what it's like? And I was like, crikey, that's I didn't know, frankly.
No. And you know, I didn't know. And I actually met Vicky Phelan many years ago in WIS when I went back to do a teacher training course there. And she's a marvellous, marvellous, inspiring lady. But in a different lifetime. But when it worked for both of us. When I started chemotherapy, I was very green. You know, I hadn't, like that, I didn't know the trials and tribulations. I had to get dropped there by my husband at, you know, 8 o'clock that morning. And amazing staff in St. Anne's Day Ward do their absolute, they're dedicated, their absolute best. They could be there with you till maybe 7 that evening, but depending on how many medications you have to have and how many pre-drugs and all that kind of stuff. It was incredibly challenging. But I had a severe allergic reaction, unfortunately, to the first one round. Now, that is very rare. But after a week of my aunt and uncle, I moved in with them for a while to kind of shield the children from some of us. And they were looking after me so well. But I knew it wasn't getting any better. So I reached out to my medical team and they brought me in. And I was hospitalized for 10 days because of a severe reaction.
Okay.
I nearly missed Noah, my youngest, starting in her infants, which was absolutely devastating for me. But they got me out. Now, I was at the school gates and I remember a friend saying she'd never seen anybody look so green and grey at the same time. I don't know if I, you know, I pushed to get out and I was had a lot of steroids on to keep upright.
Yes.
But I wanted to be there for him to go in. But it is incredibly challenging. And our families and our friends and our neighbours were unbelievably helpful and supportive. But in COVID, that was very restricted. So for a few months, it was literally the children, David and I. And, you know, and he was trying to navigate work, who were really supportive and trying to get his hours and you know, if he needed to be here in the morning or if he needed to be here in the evening to swap around and things like that. But it was tough. And my little guys, like, we shielded them from as much as we could, but they were amazing. And they, you know, the little gestures that would just keep you going. And when I was losing my hair, and I'd wear a little cap so I didn't want to frighten them, but it hurt sometimes.
Yeah, of
course. And I remember my daughter, Anna, saying to me, Mum, don't wear that for us.
Mm.
And I just, it was just their strength, their absolute strength was inspiring.
And I think it was that you said, Anna, she's 12.
She is.
She's her own thing going on.
She does. She has a few health issues herself, but okay. She's one strong girl. She's brilliant.
She sounds
girl.
It. And Sam, as you say, is also has his own thing going. Like every kid has a story to tell, don't they?
That's it. But he is the most kindest, empathetic young man you've ever met in your life. He's just amazing, amazing guy.
And then Noah's got his Dogman book, so he's sorted.
Oh, stop. He is a howl. Now, he would put, I tell you, he is hilarious. He absolutely is a character.
I suppose the upshot of it is, Caroline, is that you fight the fight, you struggle the struggle, you come through the fog of war in life, and then you look at and you suddenly see your three kids and your husband, and you think, okay, still standing.
Still standing. And it really paired everything back for us, because I probably was all go and, like, you know, any working parent and, you know, busy and running around and trying to be all things to all people. And I think when control is taken away and it's something that you're facing down the barrel, that you have to kind of sit back and realise this is out of my control. I have to put my hands in medical teams. I have to trust that we'll all get through this. But it was sometimes very tough, but it was day by day. As I said, with the people around us, we did fantastic. Some of it wasn't lost on me. You know, first round, the first lockdown, my husband was cocooning my aunt and uncle, Neil and Tommy, whereas in the second or third lockdown, they were bringing me to chemotherapy. Like, that kind of stuff wasn't lost on me, where the juxtaposition, you know, things kind of change. And even with my own, I was kind of work-wise making sure that young people were getting, you know, what they needed and the support that they needed to keep going and get through their qualifications to go on to progression routes. And then I was leaning on the the staff in my own school to kind of help my children when I couldn't do it for them, you know.
Well, I like it. I like your story, Caroline, because it is it's a story of our times, and it's reflective, but it's also a realization, and that's what I quite like. That's why I like what you've told us this morning. Hey, happy Christmas to you and yours, okay?
Thank you.
I hope you enjoy the show tomorrow night. Yeah, appreciate
best
that, and best to your gorgeous children. See you soon. Thank you, Caroline, for that. Lovely to talk to her this morning. Back shortly.